Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Damage Report. It is Wednesday. I'm John Iderola, and buckle up for another big day of the news, because J.R. Jackson is going to be joining me, a legendary producer for The Young Turks, host of JR Rated, the show that doesn't exist but should.
But pops up randomly whenever you don't
does
know,
pop up
you
randomly.
Least expect it.
Instagram, Twitter, places like that. We've got a lot that we're going to be covering today. So first of all, we missed the Bob Woodward book dropping yesterday. It happened like just as our show was ending. So we're going to go through a few quotes. I've pulled, I think, 30% of the book in quote form. So we're going to be talking about that. But we've got other news as well. Day two of the Kavanaugh hearings and also election results from yesterday's primary elections in Massachusetts. We're going to be talking about the stunning victory of Ayanna Pressley. And one other candidate as well that is not getting nearly as much coverage, but probably should. And then for the rest of the show, the second half, we are lucky enough to be joined by a pair of awesome guests. Paulina Gonzalez, who represents those who are being, legally and institutionally mistreated by the big banks, will be coming on to talk about Bank of America and their scandal involving the freezing of accounts of people with some sort of suspected immigration status issues. Not actual immigration status issues, but just the suspicion of it. They're losing access to their money. And then later on, we're going to be joined by a reporter from The Intercept. Aida Chavez is going to be joining us to talk about David Garcia, the Democratic candidate for the governorship of Arizona. We're going to be breaking down his platform, his chances, and more. But we start off with Bob Woodward, whose book Fear is coming up soon. It'll be out in about a week, actually, on September 11th. Just in case you didn't realize the stakes that he's laying out in this book. It's September 11th. And he has based this book on literally hundreds of hours of taped interviews with people in the White House. And that creates a bit of a problem for people like Donald Trump, who want to assert that Bob Woodward, multiple Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, who's done books on 8 presidents, I think, suddenly just decided to throw all of his integrity away and make up a bunch of quotes about the lyingest president in American history.
How many people were in the White House and had access and detailed questions asked of staff members, including the president himself? How many people have been there now that
a
they
lot.
Had no idea were there and that were recording everything that was going on in this dysfunctional place?
I think half of the people there are just making books, basically. Michael Wolff, obviously Omarosa and her little tape recorder,
right.
And now Bob Woodward. So look, there's so many different things we could talk about here, but I want to focus on some of, I think, the most shocking revelations, a few from yesterday, some now coming out today. We're going to get the book as soon as we can and break it down too. We've also reached out to Bob Woodward. We'll see if he'll come on the show. But first, some of the excerpts having to do with national security, because one of the narratives driving through all of these different quotes is that the people Trump has chosen to surround himself with have had to, in many occasions, actually stop him from accomplishing his goals or delay them or go behind his back to shut down one of his proposals because they believe it will either damage his presidency or endanger the country itself. They can't actually talk to him about it because he's not a person you can reason with. But here's an example of some of the issues that you might come across if you're trying to not have the country explode. Trump was talking with James Clapper, who was then the director of national intelligence, who briefed him at Trump Tower during the transition on the intelligence community's findings that Putin had interfered in the election. And Donald Trump said this, "I don't believe in human sources. These are people who have sold their souls and sold out their country. I don't trust human intelligence and these spies." So that's an interesting take. The idea that human intelligence, which is obviously an important component historically of the intelligence gathering process, we should disregard all of it because these people are traitors, is at the very least consistent with everything else about Donald Trump, wherein loyalty specifically to him is the only thing that counts.
It's almost like it has something to do with what the information is that he gets, as to whether or not he trusts it.
Yes.
It goes with the same, it's a pattern. It's a track record this guy has for if he doesn't agree with the person, the information or the news source, then it's fake. I don't trust it. It's not real. If it's something he's about, if there's people saying yes to him, if he has yes men surrounding him, those are the best people.
Yeah.
Until they're not the best people anymore because they're sick of your madness. Mm-hmm. So then once they leave, then they're disgruntled. Oh, I never liked that guy anyway. He was never really that close to me. Don't know anything about him. But from the beginning, this is, again, you said during the transition process.
Yeah.
James Clapper came to him and told him this. So after he tells him this, during the transition, from the very beginning, this is the beginning of not even the presidency, hasn't even started yet. It's you getting yourself coordinated. That's when you begin by not trusting your intelligence community. Mm-hmm. Because
it was
some information you didn't like. Dude, you're already in.
Yeah.
You might as well try and act like you're legitimate.
Yeah, and there's great examples of that, how contingent the source of the information is, whether it hurts him, whether it helps him, in that he will tweet constantly that the New York Times is fake and failing. Fake and failing, fake New York Times, failing New York Times. And then he will reference the New York Times when they have a report that he thinks is good for them.
Absolutely.
He'll call them the failing New York Times as he's referencing them, but he's still depending on them for reporting. And the same way when he talks about anonymous sources. Anonymous sources are all fake. They make up stuff, except when he quotes anonymous sources in reference to things like birth certificates and things like that. Then they're perfectly legitimate. So let's jump to another quote. Again, having to do with security, he was talking with Tom Bosert, the president's advisor for Homeland Security, cybersecurity, and counterterrorism, who asked Donald Trump at one point if he had a minute to speak. And Trump said, "I want to watch the Masters. You and your cyber are going to get me in a war with all of your cyber Shazbot." So he takes it very seriously, so long as the Masters are not on. He wants to watch the Masters because he doesn't spend enough time playing golf himself. He has to watch other people play golf. And he doesn't want to know about any of it. Like, if you think, I wonder, is he taking the cybersecurity of our elections in our country seriously? Is he protecting us from interference with our power grid, with, you know, the state level election systems? He calls it your cyber and thinks it's just going to get him in a war.
How? I was trying to put together how all that works.
I once had a conversation with my grandfather about a decade ago where he needed something, and I said, "I'll order it online." And he said, "Don't put your credit card online. They'll steal your identity." And this was Amazon. Some people, they get left behind by technology.
But you know what? Your grandfather was right. Sometimes your identity gets stolen online. Sometimes
Amazon.
Your credit card number gets stolen. Sometimes you go to an ATM at a random gas station, and then there's the reader thing, and your stuff gets stolen. Sometimes it happens. You know, it also happened. People's identity got stolen before the wave of technology.
Yeah.
It just happens. And you know, that's what your bank is for. And that's when they go, "Oh, there's $150 of charges. We'll wipe those and we'll give you a new card." It's happened to me 5 times. Anyway, the thing is that can be real. But I'm trying to figure out how that then leads to war. If your grandfather said, "Hey, John, don't go on Amazon. As you know, North Korea is going to start a war." I was trying to make
or
the connection.
Russia. I don't know. Either he thinks that taking cybersecurity seriously and telling other countries to stop attacking us will lead to a war, or he wants the people around him to believe that that is why he's saying he can't engage in this area.
Or he doesn't understand how anything works.
That's the most likely result, I think. Also, just to give you an idea of, again, how little he understands about how things works, he was editing a speech with then-Staff Secretary Rob Porter, who was Staff Secretary and domestic abuser. Trump scribbled his thoughts in a neat, clean penmanship, writing, "Trade is bad," in all caps. So here's the thing. That is a laughable thing to write down. But if that is the extent of what you believe or think or know about trade, the fact that you need to write it down to remind yourself is perhaps even more embarrassing.
It's like, I was just about to go out there and say trade is sad.
Sad.
No, let's go with bad.
It's bad. Trade is mad. At me. Okay, but I want to go to one of the most important areas, because it has to do with why it is that he has not sat down with Robert Mueller and had an interview concerning the investigation into both obstruction and Russia and all of that. So Bob Woodward described how Dowd, that was his lawyer at the time, John Dowd, made Trump sit for a mock interview to try to prove to the president that testifying would be a bad idea for him. Man. Trump apparently failed the test. Woodward writes that Dowd left convinced that the president could not survive Mueller's questioning without committing perjury. Dowd believed Trump was incapable of telling the truth. Dowd, apparently a perceptive guy. Then, after that, Trump's lawyers then went to Mueller and reenacted the scene of Trump doing the mock interview, with Dowd playing the role of Robert Mueller and Jay Sekulow playing a combative Trump. Sekulow is still one of Trump's personal lawyers, by the way. But what they were trying to do there was demonstrate to Mueller that there's no way an interview could happen because Trump would definitely end up in jail, which is the most novel legal approach I've ever seen in my life.
I don't understand how that works. If I was Mueller, I'd go, okay.
Take him. No, you did great. You did great. You're going to be just fine. Okay, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, though, Paulina Gonzalez of the California Reinvestment Coalition joins us to talk about Bank of America shutting down people's accounts over questions about their citizenship. All that after this. Last week, reporting broke that Bank of America was involved in some pretty shady business having to do with people's accounts being frozen because of questions about their citizenship status. Now, that reporting was certainly scary, but it also left us with a number of questions. Hopefully, we'll be able to figure out a little bit more about what's going on there as we're joined by our next guest, Paulina Gonzalez, the executive director of the California Reinvestment Coalition. Paulina, welcome to the Damage Report.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Very glad to have you on. So for those who might have missed the initial reporting last week, what is Bank of America alleged to have done in this case?
So what is happening is that Bank of America is sending out notices to all customers and to new customers, asking them or actually forcing them to reveal their citizenship status. And that is what is so concerning at this time.
So I guess, I mean, hypothetically, they're allowed to ask those sorts of questions, but is it in any way the job or responsibility of banks to be going out of their way to determine someone's citizenship status?
So no, what's concerning to us is that you don't have to be a citizen of this country to have a bank account. You don't have to have a social security number. And we've worked with banks to ensure that they have accounts that are accessible to everybody. And at this time, in this political climate, to be asking questions of customers of whether they are citizens of this country, whether they have dual citizenship, it sends a chilling effect across the country to immigrant communities that they're not welcome at this time in a bank such as Bank of America. So it is our position that these questions don't need to be asked. We've read the regulations, and Bank of America has gone beyond what they should be doing at this time.
So I've seen a few statements from one or another banks about all of this. If it's not their job, if it's not their responsibility, they don't have a legal obligation to gather this information, do we have any idea of why they might have apparently somewhat recently decided to begin getting in that business?
I mean, that's a question for the bank. I think that they're taking the regulations way too far. There is no requirement, as I said earlier, for them to be asking this question. The bank needs to respond to its customers, why it's doing this, and to its immigrant customers. It's having a chilling effect. It's going to be turning customers away. And really, at this point, what we think is happening is that the bank, Bank of America, is complicit in a anti-immigrant agenda by the Trump administration, and they need to immediately stop their actions across the country, asking their customers this very invasive question.
So it certainly does look that way, and it didn't escape my notice that on the same week that we learned about Bank of America, we also learned about passports being seized from American citizens on both sides of the border, those traveling in Mexico and those in Texas, and those had been born in the border area. If there is sort of complicity in this sort of anti-immigrant campaign that's going on, certainly in terms of sentiment and in terms of policy, do we have any reason to believe, and I don't know that you have access to this information, that there's coordination, or could the bank have some sort of independent incentive to engage in this sort of act?
I think that's, you know, I don't have any information about, you know, whether they are coordinating with the administration, but I think that there's definitely distrust within our communities, immigrant communities and others. We're just off a Wall Street crashing the economy. I think I would encourage I don't have any faith that the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency or other bank regulators or the Department of Justice will be looking at this matter very closely. But we definitely encourage maybe state investigators, state attorney generals to look at this very closely to see if there is any coordination on the account of the bank in this matter.
You know, I am curious, anytime I see unnecessary information being gathered by a massive corporation, the possibility that it could be either sold or passed on in some form, are there any sort of protections for people who might be offering up this information to Bank of America or other banks to protect them from that information then being packaged and sold or handed off either to the government or to some other corporation?
So we do want to be clear. The bank cannot just hand over the information to ICE or Department of Homeland Security. And so we want to make sure that immigrant communities have that in mind and they understand their rights. At the same time, we know that when you're faced with an invasive question like, you know, are you a citizen of this country? What country are you a citizen of? That there's a question whether or not somebody wants to answer that. And, you know, you're put in the position of, should I answer that or should I not? And therefore have my accounts frozen and not access to my money. And so we ask people if they are facing this question, if they don't know what to do, that they can contact us, the California Reinvestment Coalition. We can put you in touch with others who might be able to assist you, financial counselors or others. But we are also in touch with potentially state regulators who might be able to act in this respect.
Well, so I want to thank you for pointing out one area that people offering up this information perhaps should not be overly worried about. But are there any legitimate concerns for immigrants or immigrant communities around this practice, the possibility that it will continue or perhaps expand? Is there any reason that they should be worried?
I mean, I guess at this point, you know, with this administration, you never know what's going to happen. We have, as you mentioned, the passports at the border, the, you know, the public charge, public benefits that Steve Miller is going after in terms of potentially if legal immigrants are using public benefits that might harm their ability to be able to naturalize in the future. So we don't know from day to day what this administration is going to propose from one day to the next. So I can't promise that in the future something won't change. So we have to always be careful and be in contact with legal service providers, organizations like ours, and be vigilant. And that's why right now our main concern is to call on Bank of America to stop this practice immediately and to not be complicit in what the Trump administration is doing. And so that's our greatest concern right now, is to call on the bank to stop this action immediately so that there is no danger now or in the future.
Well, I want to thank you for joining the show and helping break down the situation. Obviously complex, but I feel better knowing that there's organizations like yours who are working to protect people's rights and access to information about what's actually happening. So thank you.
Thank you so much, John.
That was Paulina Gonzalez, Executive Director of the California Reinvestment Coalition. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Jared Jackson will be rejoining the show. We got more for you on Bob Woodward and also the Kavanaugh hearings and some results from last night's primary elections. Welcome back, everyone, to the Damage Report. We're talking just a little bit more about the upcoming book Fear by Bob Woodward. More for us to fear, perhaps also for Donald Trump. So there was one quote in particular that I wanted to return to, and it had to do with Donald Trump admitting what his biggest mistake was so far. And this is not a man who often does this. This is both his biggest mistake and also the only mistake he's ever made. So he said, after he said the quote, both sides, the Charlottesville white supremacist rally last year, that both sides were blamed for the violence.
Oh, maybe he's going to be worried about his saying both sides.
I know, because that's a misstep.
Right?
That's a misstep, not acknowledging that it was Nazis that killed a counter-protester and that the other people just exercising their democratic rights.
I have hope.
That's probably what it was. No. He just meant that he gave the speech at all, that he talked about it at all. It wasn't that he bungled the easiest condemnation in the history of our nation. It was that he gave the speech at all, because the Charlottesville white supremacist rally didn't bother Donald Trump, and he didn't feel like it was worth him weighing in. But he was forced to by these aides who were bending his arm behind his back.
They make him come back and take back. And everyone knew he didn't mean it when he took it back anyway, so it wasn't actually a mistake. Everyone still got your sentiment, Donald. We already knew that you didn't actually mean when you said, you know what? Yeah, you're right. The neo-Nazis and white supremacists and all those guys, I didn't mean that there was bad guys on both sides. I meant, okay, fine, they're bad guys.
Yeah.
We knew that's what he was saying as he read it like a third grader anyway.
Yeah. Now, there were a few, I guess not retractions, since that implies that Bob Woodward, admitted that he had made something up, which we have no reason to believe is actually the case. So far as I know, nothing that he has reported in his multi-decade career has ever been retracted or debunked or anything like that. But several of the people quoted in yesterday's set of excerpts have said that they did not say what they probably said. And one was White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, who said, the idea I ever called the president an idiot is not true. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Okay. I said he wasn't an idiot. All the time. I say that every day, actually.
Every time the rest of the White House staff said he's an idiot, I said he wasn't an idiot.
Yes.
Damn it.
And the ridiculous thing about that was that Donald Trump tweeted out a statement by John Kelly last night saying that he hadn't called the president an idiot. And if you were in a position where you have to ask somebody to write up a statement where they say you're not an idiot and then you tweet out that you're not an idiot, that's embarrassing, Donald Trump. You might be too much of an idiot to realize that, unfortunately. But anyway, there were other terrible things he said about Jeff Sessions and all that. Much of that was broken down yesterday on the main show, so we don't need to retread that. Yesterday night, we did have primary elections in Massachusetts. The rest of the ones from this cycle are all going to be individual states, one per night, which allows you to focus on the individual victories inside of one state. And so we're going to do that, actually. We've got inside of Massachusetts, Ayanna Pressley was able to win in U.S. House District 7, the Democratic primary, defeating not just, you know, some other Democrat, but Michael Capuano, a 10-term sitting congressman, which is impressive. If you could bring up, she actually won by a good bit, 17,000 votes is not nothing. That is certainly something. Mm-hmm. And the polls leading up to the election had her down by as much as 12 points. It was not expected necessarily that she would win, but there was a great deal of enthusiasm for her campaign. She was, you know, pounding the pavement, as they say, month after month after month. Had a number of volunteers, small dollar donations. This is a story that we've heard play out many times through these primaries. But if she wins the general, and she's expected to because it's Massachusetts heavily Democratic district, she was not only the first black female city council member in Boston, but she will be the first ever African-American female congresswoman for Massachusetts in its history, which is crazy because Massachusetts is one of the old states, not one of the new ones, you know?
Absolutely. Well, maybe that's part of the reasons behind it. A lot of times the old states have their ways of doing things. As you said, Capuano had been there, what, how many, 10?
10 terms.
10 terms.
And so, he was a relative progressive inside the Congress.
As it comes with versus Democrats versus Republicans, there's precedence and there's regular order and normal names that we're used to seeing and hearing, and we just go with it. That's what's different about this cycle. And although it's not happening, and I'm not telling you how I'm Mr. like prediction, but I figured that a widespread wouldn't happen to the degree that many progressives wanted it to. Like, oh my God, there's this wave of progressivism and everybody who said anything and did anything, the establishment is going to be out. It's not going to happen that way. But when you get a few victories, that's something. And I keep saying it like this is a good sign. And even if everything doesn't flip completely to perfection, in this one midterm, it doesn't mean that it's a failure.
Yeah.
These are big deals and big victories, and people are paying attention to it. And other people who are these types of candidates may also feel inspired to do the same, because this is tough work. As you said, the pounding the pavement, I don't have it in me.
I probably don't have it in me either. I think about it every once in a while. I don't think I
do. And to, especially to unseat someone like Capuano, who, not that he doesn't do it, but doesn't have to do it to the degree that unknown candidates have to do it.
Yeah.
People look at their ballots and they go, oh yeah, Capuano, always voted for him. Hmm. Have no idea what he's voted for, what he's done, and what he's planning to do.
Even though he's been generally good.
Absolutely. No, I'm just saying, like, it's across the board. It happens that way. That's the way voters a lot of times do, because they don't have the time to really dig into deep in the background of people, these candidates.
By the way, if you've been following the show this week, we've now got two new nicknames, JR Mr. Prediction Jackson and John Hypebeast Iderola. Anyway, I'm going to have to send that to Brooke. She will not be happy with me. So I did want to point out, in terms of the campaigning, there was the volunteer-driven, small-dollar donation focus of the campaign, as there have been in many cases. But there was also this. I found this very interesting. Alex Goldstein tweeted out, memo to potential candidates considering a run someday across America. Our only paid television ads for the entire Ayanna Pressley campaign were on Telemundo and Univision. Besides that, our message was spread entirely on the doors, phones, and via social and earned media. Which is awesome and probably the way it should be. So just, you know, bear that in mind. Now, there was a resignation, or I should say, I guess a concession, relatively early. Before it was even called by the New York Times, Michael Capuano had conceded, saying, I will tell you, I'm sorry it didn't work out, but this is life and this is okay. America is going to be okay. Ayanna Pressley is going to be a good congresswoman and Massachusetts will be well served. Which is not the most gracious concession speech ever, but I'll take it. Perfectly acceptable.
It's okay. It's pretty good.
It's not bad.
What would you have added?
I said she'll be a good congresswoman. Good is like nice. Is there any weaker compliment? You know what? When you're on the show, Jerry, you're good. That's not.
I always
like
to compare these things, because it is a comparison to like to sports when you win and lose, because sometimes people get really bitter when they lose these races. And when I've lost in sports, if it's a big deal, I wouldn't want to sit at the podium like these professional athletes do and go, yeah, they played a great game. They really beat us. And I just kind of sucked today. No. I'd be like, listen, I don't want to talk about it. I don't like them.
I hate them. I hate them more now than I did before. Okay, so one other thing I want to talk about on this race, that is, we like to see how is the media covering these sorts of things, not just after the election, but before the election. And Brett Ehrlich was able to track down from Politico, our favorite site for this sort of speculation, two different headlines. One from before the election, that was this. Is this the next Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? And it took them a while, but they did figure it out. Here's why Ayanna Pressley is not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez after the election. So good. I'm glad that you clarified that.
I'm also glad that I haven't read this article, but hopefully there's a chance that they figured out each candidate is different.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, crazy.
What do you mean?
Just this feel of this progressive and also a woman and then new to the scene. Like, everyone's a little different. You might like her more.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different state.
Yeah, it's a different state.
Different policies.
We're joking. Obviously, those are different authors and all that. And inside of one organization.
But it's a normal thought process. It's different authors, but that's normal.
Yeah, they want there to be a narrative that can continue. So this is a new story, but does it have to be a new story? Can't it fit into this? And maybe in some ways it does. I mean, they are both progressive. They are both women. But there's huge differences. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez worked on the Bernie campaign. And, you know, she had done work in her area and everything, but she's 29 years old, I believe. Ayanna Pressley is a city councilwoman. She's 44. Yeah. She'd been involved in government and all of that. These are different sorts of stories. Do your research. Stop being lazy. Anyway, and not to say that those particular authors were, but just everybody is. Everybody in the entire country. Okay, so we are going to go to our third break, though. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Aida Chavez of The Intercept, and she's going to be joining us to talk about some of her reporting. She's been following basically all of these candidates across the country, but one of them is David Garcia, who won the Democratic primary for Arizona's governor's race. I honestly don't know as much about David Garcia as I do some of these other candidates, so we're going to be joined by Aida. She's going to give us some information and talk about a little
is
bit more.
Is he like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
He's not, and here's why after this. Doug Ducey is the incumbent Republican governor of Arizona, and he's facing a challenge right now from David Garcia. But who is David Garcia, and what are his chances? The Damage Report, we're joined by Aida Chavez of The Intercept right now to help us understand this race. Welcome to the show, Aida.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. So you've been covering for The Intercept many, many campaigns across the country, and you had a great write-up of David Garcia. So who is David Garcia?
David Garcia is an education policy expert. He's a veteran. He's a dad. He is running as a progressive in Arizona.
So in terms of him being a progressive, I mean, that generally means a couple of things in this primary season. What are some of the policies that he supports that bolster his progressive credentials?
So he's running on Medicare for all. He's running on $15 minimum wage, on free college, and that's actually the focus of his campaign is education. And so he's really focusing on like paying teachers more and basically restoring education funding to pre-recession levels.
So we've been doing election coverage for these primaries pretty much every night that there is one. And it's been interesting that in some of these races going into the election night, there's a lot of hype around a candidacy that, you know, like Ben Jealous or Andrew Gillum, like there's these expectations that they might do well and we know a lot about them. But for me, with David Garcia, I mean, you're saying he's a progressive, supports these policies. I hadn't heard much about him. And honestly, since his victory, I haven't heard much either. Do you have any reason that you think that might be the case, or am I just missing it?
I have no idea why he hasn't been getting as much attention as I think he should be getting. And I agree that a lot of the times we're kind of hyping these up when it doesn't necessarily reflect reality on the ground. But in this case, I think if anyone's going to lead the blue wave, I think it's going to be him. I don't think it's going to be someone like Kristen Sinema.
Yeah. That was a frustrating race, especially because we had her primary opponent on the show just a couple of weeks before the election. That was one of the sad ones. It's been a cycle of a few of those. But I also want to talk about his chances. So Doug Ducey is the incumbent governor. Have you seen any information that gives you an idea of what his chances are, David Garcia? Does he have a shot against Doug Ducey?
Well, I think if you look at the money, all of Doug Ducey's money comes from these outside groups. And so I think that shows a weakness in his campaign because David Garcia is getting his money from actual human beings. And so that reflects like a bottom up way of campaigning and a focus on grassroots organizing, I think, is like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez path to victory.
Yeah, no, so I also want to talk about there's the hope or the expectation, depending on who you talk to, that this might be some sort of wave election, that the you know, I guess generic congressional ballot for the Dems is up by like 14 points right now. People are thinking that this might be a cycle that really favors them. But in certain communities, it isn't necessarily quite as strong. So the Latino community, which is growing cycle after cycle, votes at lower rates than many other communities. Have you seen anything that gives you reason to believe that in Arizona, maybe the candidacy of David Garcia, the way he's campaigning, is that likely to help stimulate more voting from that community?
I think so, because I think the Latino community has been asked to kind of vote on the defense, you know, like against Donald Trump, against Joe Arpaio. And I think Garcia is giving them something to vote for. Like, I'm putting your community first. And so because of that, you should consider voting for me. And I think that makes a world of a difference.
And so I want to zoom out just a little bit. So I've been following your campaign reporting throughout this cycle. And I think you and others at The Intercept have done a great job of lending a spotlight to these candidates before they're really in the national, you know, like the national eye. Generally for some of them, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it takes until literally after she wins before anyone, you know, on MSNBC even says her name. So in terms of that, is there anything about this primary cycle, perhaps across multiple races, that the media at the national level, the mainstream media, is missing about what's actually going on?
I think we need to redefine what we consider viable in politics. I think the pundit class especially thinks of viability in politics in terms of money. And as we've seen with some of the more surprising victories, money and name recognition incumbency can be taken down with grassroots organizing and with bold progressive ideas, not a Republican light Democrat.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we've seen some of those candidates are still squeaking through their primaries. It's going to be interesting to see when it comes to the general election, in which cases, you know, there might be some close elections that hypothetically, if you had a candidate who was actually pushing a sort of affirmative agenda, might have had a better chance. But also outside of the primaries, you also do reporting on Congress. And right now, this week, Congress is very much focused on the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. I'm curious from your experience reporting from the Capitol, the Democrats are certainly making a show of standing against Kavanaugh. But what do you think about their actual ability or willingness to stop him from getting onto the Supreme Court?
I feel like, no one disappoints me more like Senate Democrats disappoint me. I feel like they're still buying into the myth that there is like some mythical Republican voter that can be won over, particularly like the vulnerable senators in red states. And so I'm kind of concerned that they're going to buy into that myth, that if they maybe just vote to confirm Kavanaugh, then when it comes to the reelection, like they'll get reelected. That's not how it works. Like the country isn't evenly divided when it comes to reproductive rights. Like the country has made up its mind and it's in favor of abortion access. And so I think they're trying to appease these like evangelical voters that would never vote for a Democrat in the first place. So,
yeah. You know, it's interesting. I certainly agree. And I think that we've seen some evidence of that just today, actually, where it seems clear to me that he has been chosen because the people who put him on all these lists, you know, the Heritage Foundation, all of that, they believe that he will vote eventually to overturn Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. But even he, in talking about it, has to pretend that he's in favor of Roe v. Wade, that he supports a woman's continued reproductive freedom. So even in this area where they love to say that there's lots of Americans who agree with them, they don't actually feel comfortable actually running a candidate based on that. It's certainly not a nomination for the Supreme Court.
Right. And I would say that a lot of women are already living in a post-Roe world. Like, there's a lot of people, particularly in rural communities, living really far away from any kind of clinic. And so when it comes to reproductive rights, you can't just, you know, be like, oh, it's settled law. You have to be fervently in support for the access to those kinds of things.
Yeah, and we've certainly seen over the past few years in Texas, it being settled law hasn't really counted for a lot in terms of Texas's ability to chip away at those rights in a number of different areas. Well, Ida, I want to thank you for joining the show and helping us break down both the Kavanaugh hearings and also David Garcia's chances in Arizona. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to be moving on to those Kavanaugh hearings. Some fireworks yesterday involving one of the fathers of one of the students slain in Parkland. And if we have time, we also want to touch on a pretty stunning revelation coming out of the Robert Mueller investigation after this. Welcome back. We have just minutes remaining in this episode of the Damage Report, and I want to talk about day two of the Kavanaugh hearings. There's been a lot going on, both yesterday and on to today. A few things we need to cover. The first, though, did happen yesterday, got a lot of coverage. I want to comment on it as well, especially because one of the two people involved has actually been on this show. So Frank Gutenberg, the father of a child who was killed in the Parkland shooting, he was invited to the hearings yesterday. He approached Kavanaugh. I think they were going to a break or something like that. And Kavanaugh had an opportunity to be a human and hear out this man and shake his hand. Instead, he went in this direction. On the podcast, Kavanaugh is approached and immediately, no, not going to happen. Walks away. I think we have a slower version, actually. If we could play that.
So Gutenberg
saw the hand go out.
The left,
he sees him. He listens and walks away. And honestly, one of the things that bothers me the most about this and the coverage of it. Oh, hey, there's the woman who did the white supremacist hand signal. I'm joking. Anyway, is that all the reporting initially for a good hour was he got dragged away by security. You know, before he had a chance to shake the man's hand, he got dragged away by security. But you see the video there. That's not remotely what happened. He saw the person, he considered it, and then decided, nope, not going to do it.
Because you know what he considered? Because Fred Gutenberg introduced himself, told him who he was. He goes, my daughter was one of the students that was murdered
yeah.
At Parkland. And that's all he needed to hear.
Yeah. He knows this is not a person that's on my side. And so I'm not even. This is the guy that this morning said, I'm going to have an open mind on the Supreme Court about all issues. I'm not going to favor one side or the other. You don't have an open mind on shaking the hand of a person who lost their kid because you apparently have such hardened views on gun rights versus gun control that you can't even pretend to be a human when you know dozens of cameras are on you.
You can even
he knew he was being filmed at that point.
You can even not care that that his daughter was murdered by a school shooter again and mass shooting problems in our country. You can even not care or not agree with what that he would like for this not to happen to more folks. But you can still shake his hand and go, you know what? I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah, and you can pretend.
Move on. But for some reason, that's even too much.
Well, he did move on,
yeah.
Unfortunately, very quickly.
Because the worry is that, oh, this guy's coming to get me. Also, some of the people, at least I heard these little blurbs, they were like, oh, you know, Kavanaugh's wife and daughters were in the room and they were worried about all the outbursts and protests were happening. His kids were scared, so they had to hurry up and get them out of the room. Scared of what? So I thought security was there, number one. Number two, these folks that are yelling are saying things, not jumping over barriers to get to your kids. Who cares?
Yeah.
Nobody's coming after your kids. And Fred Gutenberg, his kid is not here.
Yeah. Also, don't bring your kids. That's weird. It's hours of testimony about torture and stuff. Don't bring your kids.
It's politics. It's a political stage.
True.
So you come in there and go, hey, nice to meet you guys. Yeah, I'm Brett Kavanaugh, and this is my wife and my daughter. Aren't they lovely folks? That's why you should confirm me. No, that has nothing to do with why I should confirm you. Why are they here?
Well, actually, let's talk about a few reasons why you might hypothetically not want to confirm him. Now, there could be any number of different reasons included in the 42,000 documents that were dumped two nights ago, probably still haven't been entirely looked over because that's a crazy task. There's far more documents that we will never have access to. Apparently, only about 7% of requested documents have actually been given in. In previous cases, it was in the 90s. I think with Kagan, it was like 97% of the documents were handed over. So here's a few issues. Do we have any reason to think that he might be hiding something or might be deceitful about an important issue? Well, back in 2006, Senator Patrick Leahy asked him whether in his time in the George W. Bush White House, he had been involved in any of the conversations about the so-called enhanced interrogation, which the English language calls torture. Was he involved in those conversations? And he said no in 2006, and he made it through those hearings. We found out later he was lying. He had been involved in those conversations. That's the sort of information that is in those documents that they don't want us to see. That he is willing to go under sworn testimony in front of all of these senators, and he's willing to lie about issues of torture. If you will lie about that, what won't you lie about?
I'll ask again, what's the point of confirmation hearings? I'm not sure if I said this here, main show, or just off camera, period. The point of confirmation hearings is to get an idea of who this person is and whether or not they should be in the position that they've been nominated for. When they lie about it, what do we do then? Mm-hmm. Or when they lie about it and then get on, what do we do then after it's
shown? We put them on the
Supreme
Court.
Yeah, and once they're there, we go, oh, yeah, he lied about that. I guess that's just the way we do things. What's the point of a confirmation? We're wasting our time. Why are we talking to him if he's just going to sit there for hours and days upon days and lie about what he's going to do, has done, or believes in?
Yeah.
Why do we care?
I don't know. At this point,
He moves on and lies. There's no consequence for those lies.
Yeah.
What's the point of that?
By the way, imagine being a Republican senator and knowing that there's tens of thousands of documents like this and not caring. I don't need to know what's in there, or at least saying that you don't care. More issues with Kavanaugh. Public Citizen has been doing investigations into Kavanaugh. And they did an analysis of his opinions in split decision cases during his 12 years in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And they found that he decided or wrote an opinion against the public interest 87% of the time in split decision cases dealing with consumer, environmental, and workers' rights. So he can say, I will have an open mind. Maybe that means 87-13 split, you know, in favor of corporations, the wealthy, the powerful, versus the people. Yep. He had 12 years to establish a record. We have that record. We know what it is. It's not in favor of me. It's not in favor of you. It's in favor of some of the Republican senators in that room, perhaps. But lots of concerns there. Also, new stuff breaking today. He won't say whether a president could be subject to a subpoena. If he's not willing to say it, I think we know which way he'll rule. He also said he won't say whether a president has the absolute power to pardon himself. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. It's just a hypothetical, You know, seems like a relevant one considering the legal situation the president's in right now. But he wouldn't say, and he wouldn't also say if the president had the absolute power to pardon someone else in exchange for a promise that that person wouldn't then testify against the president. The clearest example of abuse of the pardon power to corrupt ends that I can come up with, just a hypothetical. He won't actually say.
I think we can add all these answers to the fact that the president who nominated him wants absolute loyalty, an attorney general that will bypass everything illegal that is ever done by him or anyone he associates himself with. We can see that as a sign that this is a part of that.
Yeah.
Why can't we also vet the president who also put him in office?
Well, we are going to, even if they will not. JR, thank you for joining me. Great to have you on. Thank you for watching, everybody. If you haven't already, review the podcast, rate the podcast, listen to the podcast. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.